Dinner between friends in Paris, today on The World. Candidate Trump didn't pull any punches when it came to the French.
France is no longer France.
But today, when he met his French counterpart, President Trump was all about the positive.
A very good relationship, a good friendship. And we look forward to dinner tonight at the Eiffel Tower. That'll be something special.
Plus, Chinese Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo has died of cancer. He was a dissident, and when he won the prize, this reporter remembers asking people in Beijing if they knew about him.
I mentioned his name, and there were just blank looks, like, so is he a scientist?
Wow.
And I was like, no, he won the Nobel Peace Prize, and he's in prison.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Welcome to the show, and for President Trump, a warm welcome in Paris today. Trump flew there to meet with French President Emmanuel Macron and to attend tomorrow's Bastille Day military parade. This year, the parade will commemorate the 100th anniversary of America's entry into World War I, so it makes sense for the president to be there. But let's face it, perhaps Trump was also hoping to get away from all the nagging Russia questions back home. Didn't happen. At his press conference with Macron today, a reporter asked Trump about his son's meeting with a Russian lawyer during last year's campaign, the lawyer who was supposed to produce some dirt on Hillary Clinton. And in response, the president again defended Don Jr.
I have a son who's a great young man. He's a fine person. He took a meeting with a lawyer from Russia. It lasted for a very short period, and nothing came of the meeting. And I think it's a meeting that most people in politics probably would have taken. Mr. President?
Macron said he thought it was important not to interfere in someone else's domestic life. And then Trump jumped back in.
What a good answer that is.
Reporter Adeline Sia is in Paris. So, Adele, first of all, what does Trump hope to get out of this trip to France?
Well, other than a nice, glamorous vacation of 2 days, he's not exactly a popular guest in Europe. He's not the most popular world leader, I would say, maybe anywhere. So this visit to France may actually improve his image. I think he's wishing that some of the popularity of Emmanuel Macron is rubbing off on him. And when he goes home, you know, he has maybe a better image himself of France and better prospects for working with France.
So if Macron is so popular, what's in it for him? Could it bring down his popularity in France?
Macron is a new president, right? And he's young and untested in many ways. So it's almost like Donald Trump became Emmanuel Macron's special project. You know, many leaders in Europe have decided to ignore Trump. I mean, Angela Merkel is not really excited to meet him, and Trump's visit to England was canceled. So Macron saw an opportunity there to emerge, in fact, as a leader in Europe and say, I can do this, I can take care of this, and I will make sure that we continue to have an open line with the United States.
And yet, on the surface, Trump and Macron really don't seem to have much in common.
That's true, but if you start with what they do have in common, they both came from a business background. And in fact, Trump at the press conference himself said, you know, well, your president here, Emmanuel Macron, is intending to cut down on bureaucracy. And that's true. I mean, Macron has said that he would probably try to cut a third out of members of parliament. So they're trying to find some common ground. I don't think there is much, but there may be enough to maintain a good relationship.
There's a lot of pomp and circumstance on this trip, the visit to Napoleon's tomb, the Eiffel Tower, a military parade. Is there a sense that this is what Trump wants to see, or is Macron trying to show off French grandeur and power to his American guest?
Well, I think you answered the question. I think Macron thinks that Trump wants to see a lot of French grandeur. For any American head of state visiting in the same day Napoleon's tomb, the Élysée Palace, the presidential palace, and the Eiffel Tower, that's a pretty good touring day, I would say, pretty good sightseeing day. You have the whole history, military and otherwise, the history of France. You have the tomb of Napoleon, which is a lot of marble, a lot of gilded sculptures, which actually Donald Trump may really like. And finally, what could be more glamorous than a dinner at the Eiffel Tower? So certainly If Macron wants to be in Trump's good graces, I think he really hit it right on the head here. He really did it exactly right. And do not forget that tomorrow Trump is going to be privileged to see a military parade, the Bastille Day, July 14, military parade on the Champs-Élysées. And, you know, we all know that Trump likes a military parade and apparently wanted one for his own inauguration. So in a way, he'll be treated to what he likes best about maybe official visits. So I think all around, he's going to have a pretty good time in France. And he already said at the press conference, you have a beautiful, peaceful city, and I'm coming back. So I think that Macron has already won a few points with Trump, and that may help along a lot of people in a lot of nations.
Reporter Adeline Sia in Paris, thank you very much.
Are you welcome, Marco.
In France, anything to do with food tends to be a big deal, la gastronomie and all that. Witness all the attention on the menu for tonight's Macron-Trump lobster dinner at the Eiffel Tower. But let's focus on another food story out of France. It's about how much a lunch staple in the port city of Marseille has become a political lightning rod.
This kebab affair, this kebab outcry, is basically the reflection of the fear of invasion of Arabs or North African of Muslims in France.
That's Rim Sara Alouan. She studies religious freedom at the University of Toulouse. What's happening in Marseille is that the city authorities are taking regulatory steps to make it harder for kebab shops in the city center to get leases, which could force many of them to close. And that's led to complaints about gastronomic racism. I asked Alouan why this is hitting the lunchtime crowd in Marseille so hard.
Kebabs smells and tastes like diet can wait.
Good old kebab, yeah.
So, this is a pita bread filled with grilled meat, garnished with tomatoes, salad, onions, and it's getting political.
Yeah, but no one in Marseille presumably is coming right out and saying this is about targeting people from traditionally Muslim countries, right?
Of course, and Marseille is one of the most, if not the most, diverse city in the country. The people who are planning on banning kebabs are not going to say it that way. But they're going to use more rational ways, like we want to modernize the city center. We want to make it luxury. They use the whole gentrification process to get rid of these restaurants. If their agenda was really to protect French culture, French gastronomy, they would go after Starbucks. They would go after McDonald's. They would go after Burger King, right?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, France's far-right Front National Party had a banner at its 2013 annual convention calling for
yes.
Ni kebab, ni burger, vive le jambon beurre,
yes.
Neither kebab nor burger, long live jambon beurre, which is basically a baguette with awesome ham and just butter. I mean, it would seem to go
Absolutely.
To the very heart of the battle for what it is to be French, right?
Kebab is also a very French sandwich. These people who are trying to dictate what should be part or should not be part of the French culture have no faith in the strength of their own culture. You know, the French culture has crossed time and borders. If they think the diversity of food can be a threat, it says a lot about their insecurities and how they cannot live in a globalized world. You know, yes, ham, butter, and baguette and wine are a full part of our French culture. But kebabs is also very much part of the French culture.
Mm. Do you not see kind of the argument, though, from some French who embrace their traditional foods and as other popular and less expensive foods come in, like kebab, like burger? I mean, I've seen the fast food hamburger joints all over Paris. They get kind of defensive about their traditional gastronomy. Doesn't that argument have some merit?
I don't think it's about gastronomy. It's more about quality food. And indeed, I mean, we can't say that kebabs or burgers are extremely healthy.
Well, as you say, forget your diet, right?
forget your diet. Exactly. I mean, if you go there, there are things in the French gastronomy that are not exactly healthy. I like to say that kebabs are part of the French going out to party all night culture. You know, the only kind of restaurant open at 1 a.m. in France are literally kebabs. I would add that there are French chefs who decided to make gourmet kebabs. So that's a proof that it incorporated, yes, gourmet kebab. Food bring people together. Yes, baguette, cheese, wine are very much French. But like I said, kebabs is becoming and is now very much French as well. So the very fact that France is having this issue speaks volume about its own identity, which is in crisis. The problem is who are behind the kebabs. Most of the time, it's North Africans. Most of the time, it will be Muslims. It's the threat of the people who are already part of the fabric of this country. This is what bothers the people who are spreading this kebabophobia.
Kebabophobia. Paranoia. So Angela Merkel likes her kebab. There was also a French Socialist Party presidential candidate, Benoît Hamon, last June, revealed his love for it. This tweet from him had more retweets than the one of now President Macron revealing his official portrait, sent the same day. So Benoît's tweet pictured a messy but delicious-looking kebab surrounded by French fries. What was the caption?
In French, the caption was, "J'ai craqué." How can I say that? I couldn't resist. Zero diet. And it was actually also a response to Macron, who was on diet during his presidential campaign and whose wife prevented him to have chocolate. And he was like, I caved in.
Yeah.
And he caved on a kebab.
So it's easy,
you know,
to
what?
Do.
It's very easy. It's greasy. It's comfort food. It's French comfort food. You know, when you have a hard day, you don't want to cook. You just want something you're going to regret afterwards. You know it's bad. You know your cholesterol is going to rise up, but it's divine. And you know, the only way to get rid of a temptation is to yield to it. So by all means, have a kebab.
Rim Sarah Alouan studies religious freedom at the University of Toulouse, and on a tough day, she eats French comfort food, otherwise known as kebab. Thanks so much, Rim Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
We've got a spare minute before the break, so here's a quick out-of-this-world story, literally. You wouldn't normally describe something the size of a planet as small, and certainly something the size of Saturn would be pretty massive by our terrestrial standards. But here's the news. A team of scientists say they've discovered the smallest star ever recorded, and yes, it is the size of Saturn. One of the scientists involved is Amore Trio from the Institute of Astronomy at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He says at first the team thought this new star was a planet.
The object is so small and so cold that it is very dim and it looks like a planet to begin with. It's only when we started to investigate thinking it was a planet and dig deeper, measured the mass, that we realized that it was in fact a star.
Hang on a second. He said this new star is, quote, so cold, but don't be fooled. That's still pretty darn hot for you and me.
On the surface of the star, about maybe 2,000, 2,500 degrees. So it is hot by our standard. But it is about as cold as stars can go, and as small and as least massive as stars can go.
Okay, hang on again. When he says least massive, we're still talking about a behemoth with 300 times the gravitational pull of Earth. So not so tiny. But yes, a newly discovered star is a toddler in the star family. And Trio says it has lots of slightly bigger cousins out there.
These small stars are the most frequent in our galaxy, and they're the most favorable to find planets the size of Earth, and the most favorable to study those planets and eventually find evidence of life on them.
And so the search continues. Amore Trio is a researcher at the University of Cambridge in Britain. He was part of a team that discovered the smallest star scientists have ever recorded. One of China's most prominent dissidents has died. We remember the work of Liu Shaobo just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. I want to read you a few lines from a poem that's being shared on social media today. You want to bury him, bury into the dirt, but you forget he is a seed. The poem's being shared in honor of Chinese Nobel Peace Prize laureate Liu Shaobo. He died today at the age of 61. The human rights and pro-democracy advocate had been serving a jail sentence, but Liu passed away in a hospital where he was receiving treatment for liver cancer. Mary Kay Magstad is the host of our podcast, Whose Century Is It? She covered China for The World for a decade. So Mr. Liu started his career as a literary critic in Beijing, and later he entered academia. How did he end up becoming one of China's most famous dissidents?
Well, it started around the time of the Tiananmen protests. I mean, he'd certainly been an advocate of democracy and rights even before that. But he was on a fellowship at Columbia University when the Tiananmen protests happened. And he thought, wow, you know, this is a big deal. I have to come back and be part of this. And he joined the hunger strike in Tiananmen Square with the students. And then on the night of the crackdown, June 3rd going into June 4th, 1989, he was there and he helped to negotiate with the troops to allow the students to leave the square peacefully. Because at that point, it really wasn't clear that they were going to be able to get out without troops opening fire. He ended up serving a couple of years in prison after that and was detained several times after that because he continued to speak out for democracy.
How much of his work did you read?
I didn't read his literary criticism, but I certainly read Charter 08, which he put together on the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in December 2008, where he was calling for China to have a multi-party democracy, to have freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, basically a lot of things that would make China have the checks and balances and freedoms and rights that are enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. For doing that, for putting that charter together and eventually getting 10,000 people within China and outside to sign it, he was detained. Basically, he was charged with inciting subversion of state power. And he got an 11-year sentence for that. And in this most recent imprisonment, he developed liver cancer and was not released from prison until he was already in a terminal condition.
Did his expectations about the Chinese state and its whole kind of trajectory, did it change at all during his life?
We really didn't hear from him during the last 7 years of his life when he was in prison. I mean, even his wife was kept under house arrest because of her association with Liu Xiaobo. But, you know, one thing that he did say when we talked in 2005 was, you know, look, I don't expect change to come quickly. I don't even think it would be healthy for Chinese society for change to come quickly. But I think it will come, and I think it will come in my lifetime. Here he is saying this in our interview.
就是说我们民间的这些权利意识的觉醒也好，争取自由的言论自由的事业也好。
So I'm asking him, do you expect to see democracy in China in your lifetime? And he says, yeah, I think I can see it. And I said, you know, you hope or you think so? And he said, yeah, I think I can see democracy. And then he said, but, you know, China's a big country and its democracy is quite complex. And I think the change in China will be gradual. I hope it will be gradual. Still, I think I'm going to see this change in my lifetime. And of course, it's one of the great tragedies of this moment that he didn't.
Yeah, that is a sad footnote. He died of complications from liver cancer. If he had not been in jail, can we assume his treatment would have extended his life?
It's hard to know. I mean, you know, it's possible that if he knew earlier that he had cancer, if he had symptoms and had gone to see a doctor, that he might have gotten treatment that extended his life. He certainly asked. He expressed a desire while he was in prison, and then after he was released into a hospital in northeastern China in Shenyang City, you know, he said he wanted to go to a hospital outside of China, and the Chinese government said, no, we can't let him move. He's too sick to move.
So how do you think he'll be remembered in China and beyond?
Well, I think one of the sad things is that he's not going to be remembered by most Chinese because they don't really know about him. I mean, I remember when he won the Nobel Peace Prize, I went out in the streets in Beijing to talk to people, you know, to get a reaction. And I said, you know, did you hear that the first Chinese, mainland Chinese person just won the Nobel Prize? Like, oh my goodness, really? You know, who was it? What did they win for? And I mentioned his name and there were just blank looks like, so that, you know, censorship works in China. But let me just add that among people who have been in pro-democracy circles in China, he will be remembered as a man of integrity, conviction, and perseverance, and someone who was very brave, who kept stepping up to the plate even after multiple detentions, and who spoke up time and time again for the importance of universal human rights.
There's also the image of that empty chair at the Nobel ceremony that he won the Peace Prize for in 2010, empty because he was in jail and clearly China was not going to let him go to the ceremony. I mean, that image will also be remembered in the West in many ways, more than his face, and that's ironic.
Yeah, and in the end, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, if someone's remembered for what they stood for what they stood against, for their work, for their ideas, for their values, that's not a bad way to be remembered.
Mary Kay Magstad is the host of our podcast, Whose Century Is It? Before the break, a quick look ahead at some of the stories you'll be hearing soon on The World. We're going to hear from Mobeen Azhar, for example, who's been reporting on Pakistanis who say they don't believe in God.
On your identity card, you can identify as Muslim or Jewish or Christian or Hindu. There is no option to say that you don't believe in God or you're agnostic or an atheist. That's just not an option. So it's almost seen as inconceivable that you wouldn't believe in God.
We'll also talk with Teddy Fisher and Jane Gormley. They're student journalists at Mercer Island High School in Washington State. They write for the school's paper. The two managed to get the personal cell phone number for Defense Secretary Jim Mad Dog Mattis, so they called him up. Not only did Mattis call them back, he gave them an interview.
Talked about using history to explore ways in which notable people have dealt successfully and unsuccessfully with matters relating to warfare, foreign policy, politics.
It was really interesting to hear someone who's living history explain it to you. I was listening to I was transcribing the interview and had my headphones in and was listening to it. And it was just so surreal to hear someone kind of reiterating and reinforcing the points that our history teachers have made, but to have it be someone in his position.
That's a pretty cool tale. And tomorrow we'll have an interview with Haitian-American author Edvige Danticat, whose new book is about dealing with the death of her mother.
She was a person of a very strong faith, and the idea of possibly having a miracle was always, you know, part of our conversation.
We hope you'll join us for all those stories coming up on The World in the next few days. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a Polish author questions an accepted narrative about the fate of a town's Jewish population during World War II.
I didn't anticipate the kind of reaction. The whole country was, for several months, totally immersed in this debate.
We revisit the painful history of the village of Jadwabna. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For the rest of the show today, my colleague Nina Porzucki is taking the lead with a story that takes us back to 1941. Hey, Nina.
So last week, Marco, you'll remember President Trump gave a speech in Poland.
Despite every effort to transform you, oppress you, or destroy you, you endured and overcame.
He delivered it in a very symbolic location in Warsaw.
It was in front of a monument to the Warsaw Uprising.
The Warsaw Uprising was a 63-day rebellion by the Polish underground against the Nazis during World War II. Thousands died. Much of Warsaw was completely destroyed. And that narrative of Poland as a nation of martyrs and heroes that you heard Trump highlighting in his speech, that's a narrative that the current Polish government has embraced. Mm. But while the Warsaw Uprising is an example of extreme heroism in an almost hopeless situation, the narrative of World War II in Poland isn't always so black and white. Mm. This past winter, I went with Polish producer Ursula Sławiec to the tiny village of Jadwabna in northeastern Poland.
It's not a very big village.
No, no.
The church sits off main square. It's really, really cold.
Because the story of Jadwabna is in many ways a murkier and more complicated depiction of occupied Poland.
Right. So that's the background. And listeners, a warning here. The story you're about to hear is also graphic at times, perhaps not suitable for younger listeners.
Right. So it all begins July 10th, 1941. A hot day. People remember the heat.
You know, it's July. It's very hot. It's just they're extremely miserable. There are all kinds of little episodes that are documented.
Jan Gross is a historian at Princeton. That summer, he says, the region is on edge. Jadwabna is not too terribly far from the modern borders of Belarus and Lithuania. In 1941, though, borders were an ever-changing fact of life in occupied Poland. The village had actually been under Stalin's brutal control for nearly 2 years, until this moment.
This is a moment in the summer of 1941 when Germany launches its attack against the Soviet Union.
German soldiers are roaming the countryside, unleashing violence across the region, especially against Jews. Gross says this is when
mass killings of Jews by Germans begin.
Tensions have been mounting for some time in the village. There are whispers that the Jews were communist collaborators backing the Soviets. On July 10th, these whispers become shouts.
And it starts by Jewish population being ordered to assemble on the town square.
Ordered by their neighbors to clean up the lawn, weeding.
Pulling out blades of grass from the ground. Surrounded by a growing crowd, beaten up. It's a lot of people. It's huge.
The Jewish men are then taken to a nearby square where they are told to knock down a statue of Lenin that had been erected during Soviet rule. Then the men are marched to a barn on the outskirts of town.
They carry this broken up statue to bury it within the barn. While they do it, they get killed.
The women and children left weeding in the main square are corralled en masse to the same barn.
The barn is locked and some kerosene is poured on it and it's set on fire.
The barn burns down to the ground.
That's what happens, you know, it's just a horrendous episode. And what's so unusual about it is that there is an effort to round up every Jew. In early July of 1941, the German mass killings of Jews that were already taking place were not of that kind yet.
Today, the town square is a large park covered in snowy ice. It's surrounded by shops and houses. The church sits on one end of the square. It was built in the late 30s. A date on the gate says 1937. I peek inside the church looking for Ursula.
Where did they go?
It's school break this week, and the village kids are assembled in the pews for church camp. A few girls pastor a young priest with a guitar about what to sing next. My producer Ursula speaks with the young popular priest. His name is Father Seraphine. Will he talk with us about the history of the town? Sure, he says, after Mass. If wars leave scars, then Poland has a deep red gash through its middle. Poland was the epicenter of World War II in Europe. For 6 years, the country was fought on both fronts. Stalin from the east and Germans from the west. 5 million Poles died during the war, 3 million of those Polish Jews. That's one-fifth of the population. No village was untouched. Fragments of the war are still everywhere today. In fact, just this past week, 2 unexploded World War II bombs were found, not too far from the village of Jawbabna. What does this do to a nation? Michal Bilewicz studies hate.
The scale of hate speech, the mechanisms of hate speech, why people use hate speech.
He's a professor of psychology at the Center for Research on Prejudice at the University of Warsaw. Growing up in Poland, he noticed what he calls the, quote, remnants of Poland's diversity. Abandoned Jewish cemeteries, memorials to massacres. And he wonders as well, how do all of these remnants affect the psyche of a nation, his nation?
The country that's affected so much by genocide, historical genocide, it becomes a very salient issue.
I met Bilewicz after he presented his most recent study at the Sejm, the Polish parliament. He was alarmed to discover in his study that over the past 2 years in Poland, there has been a marked uptick in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, though there are very few Jews and even fewer Muslims.
In a country that has no immigration, it was absurd.
But as Bilewicz began examining his results, he found it might not be that absurd. That, in fact, the rise of hate in Poland correlated with the rise of something else, nationalism. In 2015, Poland elected a right-wing nationalist party called the Law and Justice Party. They campaigned on a platform of Poland first. Anti-immigrant rhetoric was rampant.
The leader of Law and Justice,
a man named Jarosław Kaczyński,
said that the refugees might be spreading parasites, illnesses. Their influx in Europe is actually a biological risk. This is something he openly expressed publicly, and then he presented himself and his party as the defender of the nation. And this is how you make voters.
It's like very scarily reminiscent of, I feel like, Nazis and Jews, like painting a picture of the disease.
Jews are rats. The Soviets are bringing rats together with them, and the rats were Jews. This imagery was used on Nazi posters in the occupied Europe, and particularly the occupied Poland. Why? Because this is a very effective way of reducing a chance of any helping behavior.
From 2014 until 2016, Belewicz says hate speech online and on television in Poland grew at an alarming rate. This is the same time the Law and Justice Party is campaigning on their anti-immigrant platform. It's also the period when refugees are arriving to Europe in record numbers. And the thing is, the more hate speech we see, the more we stop seeing it, according to Belewicz.
And this is very dangerous, because the more normal it gets, the more people are willing to offend other ethnic minorities themselves.
Since coming to power, the Law and Justice Party has refused to resettle refugees arriving in Europe. Mass ends. We look for Father Serafin. He is nowhere to be found. We walk to the rectory behind the church in search of the missing Father Serafin.
I mean, I wouldn't want to talk either.
Another priest appears. Ursula inquires after the father. The priest at the door tells us Father Serafin is no longer available to speak with us. No one is available to speak with us.
We chickened out. Nothing to do with it.
For nearly 60 years in Jawabna, there's a monument on the edge of town at the site of the barn. It commemorated the mass murder of the Jews at the hands of the Germans.
But this is untrue. They were killed by local people.
In 2000, Jan Gross published a slim book entitled Neighbors that shook Poland to its core. In the book, he attributes the events on that July day not to the Germans, but to Poles. Neighbors killing neighbors.
I didn't anticipate the kind of reaction which followed. The whole country was for several months totally immersed in this debate.
Should we try and talk to some people on the street?
In 2001, reporters swarmed the village of Jawabna, and debates consumed Polish TV talk shows. The Institute of National Remembrance, a government agency that was formed to examine crimes of the past, began an investigation at the site of the barn. They exhumed bodies and found keys of the victims who had taken care to lock their homes that day. They found the statue of Lenin. They also found bullet casings. The Institute of National Remembrance published a many-volume report confirming the narrative that Poles may have been responsible for the deaths of their neighbors. And it wasn't just in Jawabna they found. Many villages in the region experienced similar events.
What kind of a question do you want to ask?
Because are you from here? What are your thoughts about the monuments?
We approach an older man on the street. His face is rough and red. He doesn't want to give us his name. He says he's from around. Ursula asks him if he's been to the Jewish monument.
I have you.
As he answers, the older man slowly shrinks away from us behind a car. Ursula interprets.
I've been once to the monument. I saw on TV when President Kwasniewski opened the whole celebration, but they were talking that Poles kills all the Jews. And, well, I don't know myself. I can't know.
The older man is referring to July 10th, 2001, the 60th anniversary of the massacre.
A national ceremony was organized.
The whole country tuned into that ceremony on TV.
The president of Poland came there. A new monument was put up. The old one that attributed the murder to Germans was removed. The then president, Aleksander Kwaśniewski, spoke.
The president apologized, leaders from the Catholic clergy spoke, and the Israeli ambassador to Poland at the time, Shevek Weiss, also spoke that day. Weiss is a Polish Jew and a Holocaust survivor, and his speech was perhaps the most striking moment of the ceremony.
He said, and this was very memorable, that there were all kinds of barns in Poland, the one like near Jawabna, but also a barn in which he and his family were saved.
Yes, Weiss had been saved by a neighbor, hidden in a barn. In the years after Gross's book, the Polish government has worked hard to highlight that other kind of barn, the barn that Israeli ambassador Shevek Weiss spoke about at the commemoration, the barn that saved him.
And I don't see anything bad in commemorating the righteous.
Again, psychology professor Michal Belevich.
But the problem is the way it is conveyed today, because the way it is conveyed is, to me, a blasphemy to the memory of the righteous.
There's been pamphlets and books written, speeches given about the Poles who saved the Jews, called the righteous of the nation. Last year, the first museum even opened, dedicated to a family of Poles who saved Jews during the war. This year, on Holocaust Memorial Day, Polish Airlines, LOT, handed out a pamphlet to each passenger about the righteous of the nation.
This is creating an impression that everybody was righteous.
And it's just not true, he says. In fact, helping behavior is rare for us humans.
If someone fainted on the street, how many people will help that person? Only few people. We know it from experimental studies in psychology that helping behavior is very rare. And so now I see this process in Poland of building the identity of a rescuing society. The whole society was collectively rescuing Jews during the Nazi occupation. For me, it's a very personal issue because my family members, my grandfather and my grandmother, survived the war also with the help of heroic people during the Holocaust. And I really want these people to be commemorated properly. And also the memories of my grandparents were that not everybody, far not everybody, was rescuing Jews in Poland during the Nazi occupation. And for many Jews, including my grandmother, Poles posed greater risk to her survival than Germans, because the Germans could not recognize who's Jewish and who's not Jewish, and Poles could recognize. So these are personal memories. Sorry, I mean, it's not maybe a topic for, you know, intellectual debate about psychology of xenophobia in Poland, but these memories do not get represented in the new Polish historical memory.
Emphasizing the story that every Pole was righteous makes it easy to ignore and even deny what happened in Jedwabne, says Belevich. In fact, in an interview last summer, Poland's Minister of Education, Anna Zalewska, backtracked on the story. The tragic situation that took place in Jedwabne is controversial. Many historians, eminent professors, show completely different scenarios, she said. Zalewska is not alone. The current Polish president, Andrzej Duda, has been wishy-washy on the topic of the Holocaust. We did not, as we are falsely accused by others, participate in the Holocaust, he said in a televised debate in 2015.
Okay, let's go to the cultural center.
Back in town, Ursula gets word that two women at the cultural center might be willing to talk with us about the history of the town. Inside, we meet Marzina and Katarzyna. Katarzyna is an elementary school teacher in town. She's got curly brown hair and round, sweet face. Her colleague, Marzina, is a bottle blonde with blue eyeshadow. They both run the arts programming for the kids at the center. They're about mid-30s. Neither cracks a smile. They offer us tea and biscuits.
Very nice. Have you gotten tired of Jedwabne always being in the news and being an example of some hard history?
Marzina answers as Ursula translates.
I was not touched personally because at the time I was working hard till 5 p.m. and I have no bigger thoughts on it.
Katarzyna chimes in. She tells us that the local community felt totally isolated from the debate in 2001, that they had to accept what these outsiders were saying about their town and their ancestors, that there was no debate, that they didn't know what to believe, and they still don't.
Did she hear before, like, Jan Gross's book and before the sort of news broke out, did people talk about this? Was it actually...
A czy ten, to, te wydarzenia właśnie...
At this point, their shyness has completely worn off. Both women grow animated, angry even, talking over each other.
Marzina says that was shocking for me to hear all those news, because I remember having this little monument. It was always there, much smaller. It was said that Jews were killed by Germans here. And to commemorate them, we even went to the monument from time to time. Someone lighted a candle, and it was like always present in the map of town. Then when I heard about the whole story, it was just a total shock for me. I said to myself, like, I'm living here from like all my life, and I didn't hear about those events. How is it possible? And then Katarzyna explained that it is even more difficult for people to deal with this heritage, horrible heritage that they got, because they are a new generation that had nothing to do with those events. They just received a news one day that probably their families were involved, and they couldn't say. People who were present at the time, they were not there anymore, so they couldn't ask anyone. But they were just left with the feeling of guiltness and nothing else.
They tell us that they do not believe the findings from the investigation done by the Institute of National Remembrance. Remember, they exhumed the bodies, found the keys, the bust of Lenin. Walking out of the cultural center, my producer Ursula is upset.
They have no idea. I'm sorry, but that was my impression. Like, the Institute of National Commemorance made the whole investigation. It was just closed. They have no clue about the history, and this is... well, kind of understandable mechanism of defending oneself. They just inherited something that they can't really fight, so it must be really hard from like psychological point of view, and really right. Affecting the whole psyche of the community, right.
Especially, it's getting late, the sky is starting to turn pink. We decide it's time to find the Jewish monument.
I remember it was close to the woods. It looked
there's a cemetery
like
straight ahead.
There are many ways of dealing with the past. Accept it, grieve it, adapt it, ignore it, deflect it. 2 years after Gross's book came out and the new monument had been erected and the Polish president had come to apologize, psychologist Michał Balewicz and his colleague did a study on Polish attitudes toward Jawabna.
We found that 1 year after these events were discovered, most people in Poland really negated these facts. They said either that these were Germans who did it, not Poles, or these people were killing because they were under pressure. They used all these exonerating explanations of the fact, not to say the truth, which was that Polish inhabitants of Jedwabne killed Jewish people in Jedwabne.
From a psychological point of view, denial makes sense, he says.
Poland very fast went to the language of guilt and shame, raising societal emotions about these problems. How now we should construct our identity, we should feel shame of that, we should feel guilty, and so on. So it was a little bit like imposing emotions of people before they really acknowledged the fact.
And while the country grappled with Jawabna and this shame and denial, the Law and Justice Party was born.
Law and Justice, they started exactly in the same time.
The right-wing Nationalist Party, currently in power in Poland, was founded in 2001. And the party used the controversy in Jawabna as one of their talking points.
They made these press conferences saying, Jan Tomasz Gross is offending the Polish nation. So this is exactly the start of the Law and Justice, is exactly the time of Jawabna debate in Poland.
Oh, I'm going to fall on all of this ice.
Yeah.
Maybe it's right there. Straight ahead with the flag.
Yeah.
So it's still sort of like in the middle of a bunch of fields.
Yeah.
The Jewish monument sits at the edge of a snowy field. The actual placard is a concrete slab with what looks like the charred door from the barn embedded into the slab. An Israeli flag stuck into the frozen ground flaps in the wind.
It looks like somebody is driving up to the monument. It's kind of interesting. I wonder who they are.
A black car pulls up. An older man and young woman exit the car.
Did you come here to visit the monument?
Lump.
Where are you from?
Yeah, we came to visit the monument.
You came to visit the monument?
In the end, what did Jan Gross want from his book? From this little town, from Poland.
It's very simple. You have to acknowledge it. And once you acknowledge it, then you look around the world and it turns out that it happens everywhere. In Yugoslavia, for example, neighbors were killing neighbors. You just take a look at Rwanda and you will find that neighbors were killing neighbors. So, well, Poles, it turns out, are human beings like everybody else.
What brought you here? Where are you from?
I'm from Israel.
This is Adi and her father, Haggai.
Did you have family in from Poland?
Yes. My father's family is not far away from here.
My mother and my father.
Yeah. Adi tells me that her grandparents, Haggai's parents, escaped the war and immigrated to Israel. And it was a Polish neighbor who saved their lives.
And that man, the Polish Rozinski?
Vladek
Rozinski. He helped the family escape.
He was a neighbor, and he helped the family. He helped to cross the bridge. It's a story, it's a big story.
This shows that people were living in coexistence. It's important to know that and still remember this story, that there was a coexistence in Poland, but nothing is perfect and stuff are complicated.
Haggai pulls his daughter Adi towards the monument. He wants to say Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead. He lights a candle.
יתגדל ויתקדש שמי רבה.
אמן.
בעלמא דברא קריאתה וימליך מלכותה ויצמח פורקנה ויקיים משיחה. ויחרינו ויוכלים לחיי כל בית ישראל בעגלה וזמן קרוב ואמרו.
אמן.
ישמע רבה ובורך לעולם ולמאה.
The cycle of history. What a story. The world's Nina Porzuki there. An earlier version of her story aired on our podcast, Whose Century Is It? You can see pictures of what it's like today in the Polish village of Jedwabna over at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Hope you can be back with us tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.